Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a fantastic show for you this evening. Mike Ginter, AOPA Senior Vice President of their Air Safety Institute, is here. We're going to learn about his personal story, talk about what they've learned having to do with aviation safety for general aviation from the past, and also what we can do better in the future. And I'd like to take this moment to wish you all a happy new year. I hope that you had a wonderful holiday break, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here in 2025 with you on Social Flight Live. Looking forward to another great year. So thank you so much for joining us this evening. Before we get started, just a few things. First of all, it's a new year and things are booming inside of Social Flight. We have tens of thousands of aviation destinations and events, lots of things going on, lots of activity, by the way, within our FAA learning system. You can go onto Social Flight, whether it is a bright sunny day if you're in that part of the country, or it is cold, dark, and snowy for the rest of us in the northern climates, and you can find courses that are out there for wings credits. If you're mechanic, you can get Aviation Maintenance Technician Awards Program credits. And if you are a mechanic with an inspection authorization, you can get your IAA renewal continuing education directly through Social Flight, completely free on your time and your schedule. Just go to socialflight.com and hit the FAA credit section. You'll see all of those courses and lots of great stuff to do. Now, in addition to that, we also have our Fly to Win Challenge. That's where you fly to different airports, you get points, you win prizes. Well, we just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset, and now we're giving away another one on February 1st. All you need to do, get the app, check in, win. The odds are in your favor. Just get out there, go fly. If you manage to go to lots of airports and get on our leaderboard, you get extra chances to win. And so just enjoy the fun and let's kick off to a wonderful 2025. Tonight's broadcast is brought to you by Phillips 66 lubricants, including the Phillips 66 Cross Country XC20W50 multi-weight oil that I use in our company Bonanza. Have used that for, at this point, decades of flying. Absolutely have had nothing but good luck with that oil, as well as their Victory line of oils with their Lycoming anti-scuff additives and anti-wear additives. And Phillips 66 also has a great anti-rust preservative oil if you're not able to fly your aircraft very often during the winter. So check that out, as well as hydraulic fluids and so much more. You're going to see a lot more educational content in that FAA Learning Center I just talked about, in the work that we are doing between Phillips 66 and Social Flight. So lots and lots of good stuff. Now on to tonight's guest. I am so excited for this. Mike Ginter leads a team of seven aviation safety experts at AOPA working tirelessly to reduce the general aviation accident rate by providing free educational resources and supporting initiatives that improve flight safety and grow the pilot population. And I'll tell you, they have been successful. AOPA's Air Safety Institute content is viewed over 10 million times per year, and the GA fatal accident rate has trended down for the last 30 years. And personally, I believe that they have had a significant impact in making that change happen. Mike served for 27 years as a United States Naval Aviator, logging 555 carrier landings, 213 of those at night, and over 5,400 hours in various military and general aviation aircraft during his 40-year flying career. He earned his private pilot certificate in high school, flying Grumman Cheetahs and Tigers, which are very dear to my heart because that's where I started as well. He owned a Navy SNJ-5 version of the ubiquitous T-6 Texan, and for 12 years, and he has also been president of the North American Trainer Association, which is a type club for T-6 and P-51 aircraft, and spearheaded AOPA's General Aviation DC flyover last year. He is everything you could want in a safety advocate and leader within the general aviation community. I am thrilled to have him with us here tonight on Social Flight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Mike Ginter.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, welcome, Mike, and thank you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on the show.
That's a pleasure, and I got to tell you, that's a heck of an intro you gave me, and I'm just a GA guy at heart.
It is well-deserved, my friend. You know, you have come from such a fascinating background. A lot of people don't get such a mix of military and aviation and advocacy and understanding the inside of how so many different things work. Even within GA, I love that you've focused on the formation side, on the warbird side, but also on airports advocacy. There's just way too much to talk about. So I'm gonna ask you to tell us a little bit about your background so we can understand, how did you get to be the Mike Ginter we know now?
Wow. I fell in love with airplanes at about 9 or 10 years old, and I never gave up. And that's the short answer. I mean, it was a kid in a pretty good sized family in South Central Pennsylvania. Mom and dad both worked. Wasn't a lot of extra money for new cars, certainly not for flying lessons. So it took me 3.5 years to get my license in high school by bagging groceries and putting Christmas and birthday money towards flying lessons. It was absolutely the wrong way to do it if you look at how to do it now, right? You know, I got my license at the age of 18, right after my 18th birthday, and that was a big accomplishment for me. And I knew I wanted to fly, so I went to Embry-Riddle after high school with a very ill-informed expectation that I would graduate with my degree, all my ratings, and pick the airline that I wanted to fly for. That was how it was going to work, right? And it took about 3 semesters for me to realize that there's 1,500 hours and an ATP license and a lot of turbine time, and that wasn't something you buy. So everybody I talked to said, think about joining the military. Get your time there, then go to the airlines. So I started talking to the folks that were in the Navy and the Air Force and the Army. And the Navy rep was a retired 2-star admiral who was the dean of academic affairs at Embry-Riddle. And He kind of took me under his wing, paid me $5 an hour to work on weekends, and was kind of my mentor, and wrote me a nice recommendation for the Navy, and that hit home, and I got accepted for a pilot spot. So right after college, I went to Pensacola and started officer candidate school, and was a 90-day wonder, and right into flight school. And the funny thing happened at the 7-year point, after flying for 5 years after getting my wings, I fell in love with it, and I could have gotten out. All my friends did. And I decided to stay in, and I did that 5 more times. I stayed in for 27 years. I had a blast. Wow. It was great.
That's fantastic. Tell me a little bit about, in the very beginning, you know, people get the bug for many reasons. Did you have any connection at all, whether it was inside the family or friends, like, or were you just at the gate or just at airport fence or just looking up? What is it that drove you to that?
It's not a sexy answer, Jeff, but the answer is... I was probably 10, and I accompanied my mother to a foot doctor's appointment and in York, Pennsylvania, my hometown. And I'm sitting in the waiting room. She's getting her toenails looked at, and the doctor was a pilot, and I never met the guy before. I'm 10 years old, right? And there was a flying magazine amongst all the other Cosmopolitans and Vogues and, you know, Good Housekeeping and whatever. So I picked up the flying magazine, and by the time she came out, I asked the receptionist if I could take it with me. And she said, sure, honey, take it with you. So I took that magazine home. And this was probably, well, I was 10, so it would have been 1972. And I consumed it cover to cover and started bugging Mom, when are we going back to see the foot doctor? And she's like, why do you want to do that? I said, well, I want another magazine. Then I realized that they sell them. Back then, they sold Flying Magazine on some of the bookshelves. So I started looking at flying magazines, and that's where my dream hopping stopped. You know, firefighter, race car driver, pilot. Okay, that's it, pilot. And I just got lucky and found an inspiration, and that led to the Civil Air Patrol, and that led to meeting a flight instructor, and that led to a ground school, and I failed the written the first time, and which was a real kick in the butt. And then I took an AOPA weekend ground school course and came back and got a 96, and and then it was off to the races. So it was it. I had a passion, and very happy and blessed in my life that I was able to keep chasing that passion. And in whatever direction it took, I had no clue I would end up at AOPA, you know, as an airport advocate for 6.5 years, and now the Safety Institute director.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and I love those stories, especially. I mean, let me just ask, how did you get the questions answered, or even to know how do you get started, how do you do that? Because a lot of people don't have that. And I know Air Safety Initiative also is about growing the pilot population.
Right. How I figured it out was I was an annoying young kid asking questions of everybody around an airport. I mean, frankly, that's what it was. Every airline pilot, every military pilot, every pilot at the airport, I'd go hang out and hang on to the chain link fence, you know, and watch the airplanes come and go. And you ask enough people, and the answer is always the same, you know, take a flight lesson, or let me take you for a ride. And that just fueled the fire. So it's, you know, as you probably know, and I'll bet you your listeners would agree that, you know, you take somebody for an airplane ride, they either love it or they're neutral to hate it, right? And the ones that love it, I mean, those are the ones you inspire and you nurture, and you give them the gift of a discovery flight, get them really going. If they love the discovery flight, maybe their second flight ever, then it's up to them. And if the passion's strong enough, they'll figure out how to prioritize the funding. And that's what it was all about. I was not raised in a rich family, and you know, here I am. My airplane, I have a Bonanza, wife has a 172, and I'm pinching myself. It's great.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So clearly you had the passion as soon as you got behind and someone gave you a chance to go flying. Did you find the physical act of flying, or the mental side of understanding all the different aspects of flying, did you find that to be fairly natural for you, or was that a challenge for you?
It was a challenge. I was an average to below average student in high school, and I was the middle grandkid of 19 grandkids, you know, my big, huge family, bunch of cousins. And I was the first one to go to college, so lots of pressure on me not to fail. And I also was chasing the flying dream down in Embry-Riddle, and still flying on weekends when I could afford it. But it was just a matter of keeping sight of the goal and tackling every one of the small challenges that led to achieving all the bigger challenges, right? Mm. So that was it. I mean, if you love something enough, I don't care what it is, you can figure out how to do it. But I was a below average student in high school, and my passion for flying and my desire to be in that world, whatever it looked like, was enough motivation for me to end up on the dean's list in college, which, you know, who would have thunk that? I mean, so of course I was dean's list until I got accepted to the Navy and then graduated with a 2.7 QM. So everybody here listening can do the math. I pretty much slid out of the college with a degree and a guaranteed pilot spot. And thank God I didn't screw that up, because you can't do much with an aeronautical science degree from Embry-Riddle.
Okay. So then here comes the next one then. So why Navy? I know you Navy guys are pretty competitive with all the Air Force folks we've had here on the show, any other services that are out there. Tell me what you're into the Navy, for Navy.
Let me just get something straight right up front, Jeff. I don't want to make fun of the junior service. We love the Air Force, and
Careful, you got Marines, you've got everybody, you've got Army aviators that have been here, you're a big crowd.
Yeah. How did I pick Navy? The Air Force ROTC unit was at Embry-Riddle, and that's all they had at the time. It was a much smaller school than it is now. This was 80 to 83. I was in Daytona. And they had a Naval Aviation Club. And so I think I joined the club at the suggestion of this retired two-star that I was working with on weekends. And he really was a mentor, more than I ever knew. Looking back on it, he really kind of got me started. But he encouraged me to join the club, and I did. It was totally extracurricular. And I think we did a field trip to Pensacola and watched the AOCS graduation and watched all the training and the helicopter dunker and water survival training. It was just really cool. And when I decided to apply and he wrote me the letter of recommendation, I think we had to have three letters of recommendations. His was probably the one that got me in, right? So, and that was it. I mean, I guess when you're successful in life, you got to be willing to jump through the doors that are open for you or that you're pointed towards, right? Mm. You can't just wait for everything to be laid on your lap. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your experience in the Navy. You were on multiple tours, but specifically what it was like for you with the adjustments of flight training, with flying on a carrier. Take us inside a little bit as to what that felt like.
So the best thing I did before I went to the Navy was come in with a pilot's license. I actually had my private in high school. Embry-Riddle didn't recognize that, so I earned the private a second time. So I was a really good private pilot by the time I, quit the flying curriculum.
Hold on, Embry-Riddle didn't recognize your private certificate?
No, you had to have a commercial. You might had to have a commercial or maybe even a commercial instrument for them to start you at that level and keep going.
Oh, okay.
But I had about 65, 70 hours and a private license only. So I basically had to start over, which was fine. I learned a lot more the second time around. But and I got through all that pretty well. But the challenges were you're asking about Navy challenges.
Yes.
It was easy for me to do well in primary flight training, and when I was there was the T-34 Charlie, the Turbo Mentor, right? Turboprop, two-seat Bonanza. It was a little rocket ship. And I did pretty well because it was not a new learning environment. I didn't have a hard time with scan and, inverted flight, or that was the fun part. I was doing new stuff. I was doing formation flying and aerobatics, and I didn't do any of that when I was in my private curriculum. So it was not a new learning environment, and as a result, I did well, and I had like number two in the class. So I was on the Commodore's list. So that allowed me to select the pipeline that I wanted. The pipelines were jets, helicopters, or maritime. Maritime were C-130s, P-3s, some of the big stuff. So I chose jets, that was an exciting thing. And I thought, well, I can, as long as the airlines accept single engine jet time, then I'll be okay. Because I was still chasing the airlines. And I found plenty of airline pilots that had gotten in and hired after flying A-7s or A-4s or, that kind of stuff. So I chose jets, and that's when it got harder for me. I was back to being just an average student, average pilot, I had one, what they call signal of difficulty. I got a down on my fourth A-4 Skyhawk flight. So I got T-34s in Pensacola. I went to Kingsville, Texas, where at the time we flew T-2 Buckeyes as intermediate jet trainers and then A-4 Skyhawks. You finish that, get your wings, go to the fleet. So I progressed through in Kingsville to my fourth flight in the A-4 Skyhawk, and that was the safer solo check ride, And I got a down from my instructor because of my scan in the landing pattern on the meatball. You have 15 to 18 seconds, wings level in the groove, and the scan is meatball lineup, angle of attack. It's drilled into your head. Every Navy pilot knows that. And I wasn't apparently doing that fast enough to see the corrections needed and make the corrections fast. So that was substandard, so I got it down. And I'll tell you what, that was a dose of reality and humility. I was like, oh my God, I've never had a challenge like this before. So I really had to buckle down. And it was mostly, as I look back on it, it was mostly an attitude check. Am I able to handle the adversity and get back on the track of learning and doing better? And I did. The joke was the instructor in the back was an old F-4 jock, and he would show up at the briefing after I got this down. He was going to give me some extra training flights, and he brought a toilet plunger with him. And I said, "What's that for?" And he said, "I'm going to stick it to the back of your helmet and go meatball lineup angle attack, meatball lineup angle attack." So he was pretty lighthearted about it. It lightened the mood. It was all good. I did my two extra training flights and a refly. I passed, and I went into solo and all the ACM and stuff. And then the next big challenge was landing on a ship. We had to do that in the T2 four times, and then the A4 six times, ten traps total to get your carrier call. And I'll tell you, when you go to the ship for the first time, you're solo. There's no instructor in his or her right mind that'll sit in the back seat with a student. So you go solo after tons of practice at the landing field. And the first time you see that ship, it blows your mind because you're not prepared for that. You're not prepared for the visuals. You can do all the procedures. You've done it 100 times. And I just thank God I didn't have an emergency, because I was on such rote memory with landing checks and landing pattern and flying where I'm supposed to be. And all I had to do was get to the start where I had 15 to 18 seconds of wings level in the group and hope that I didn't screw it up. And I had average grades. I didn't miss the wires. I got my qual and then I got sent off to fly the S3 Viking and the rest was history. Wow. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, that's amazing. I want to pick up on something that you said there because you mentioned the meatball, you mentioned angle of attack, and the FAA recently came out with a recommendation saying how angle of attack could really, in their opinion, help safety. Obviously, we're about to really dive into safety during the discussion. And I want to hear how it worked in Navy flight for you, because when I think of avionics that we've got, you've got companies, especially like Aspen and UAvionics that are partners here and supporters of Social Flight. Well, they have software-driven angle of attack that is simple. If you already have the system installed, it's easy to follow. It gives you a different perspective on how maybe the fly approaches more precisely, and B, really how to be alerted to something way before a stall warning that may be different from that. And something like the Aspen Evolution even does it with understanding flaps up versus flaps down. So there's a big, big impact. But you've done it for real, trying to land on a carrier. So tell us what that's really about, flying angle of attack instead of an airspeed.
I will. You're talking about the December 26th, the FAA put out a special airworthiness information bulletin.
Yes, sir.
It's not an airworthiness directive. It's not required, but very well written. And it basically recommends that all types of aircraft, Part 91, should install and calibrate an angle of attack system. It's a recommendation, certainly not a mandate. And the second recommendation is to get training on it and use it. And that's the key. That is the most important thing. I bought a Bonanza that had an angle of attack indicator indexer on the glare shield. And I'm familiar with how to use it, which I'll talk about in a second, but it was almost a distraction for me. And I have to go back and kind of go through the operating manual for that thing now that I'm really comfortable with the airplane and see if I can start flying the airplane better using angle of attack. Hmm. In the Navy, when you're coming aboard the ship, you want the tail hook to be lower than the main landing gear. If you land flat, the hook's going to skip and you're going to miss the wires. So you have to come in at a nose-up pitch attitude. And the way that's done in the Navy is you fly L over D max, which is irrespective of weight and configuration. It's the angle of attack that is lift over drag max. And it's calculated automatically. We had a dimensionless gauge in the instrument panel. We had an indexer up top with the red down arrow, the green up arrow, and an amber donut in the middle. And the goal was to put the amber donut should never go off. If you were an amber donut and an arrow down or an arrow slow, you were a little faster or a little slow, which might have been one unit. I mean, that might have been 1.5 knots. And the faster you are, faster than on speed, L over D max, the more your hook comes up because the less angle of attack you have. So that was the whole reason we flew angle attack in the optimum AOA. We could calculate it very easily. It was on our landing checklist items. On downwind, it was 105 knots plus a knot for every 1,000 pounds of fuel we had on board. So it was typical to come aboard at 112, 113 knots as L over D max. And that was just a cross-reference to mm-hmm. once you got the donut lit, you trimmed up, hands off before you turn the turn to final. There's no base leg in the Navy. It's a descending left-hand turn. But before you turn off the perch, it was to cross-check that your AOA is centered at the airspeed you calculate. So all that was done in the checklist. But once you're on speed, you never want to get off being on speed. And if you're on speed when you hit the wires, you're going to catch a wire and you're going to stop. It's kind of nice. And that's the whole goal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a ton of sense. And you mentioned something I think that's really important, which is it's not just about, hey, having some feature on your panel. You need to integrate it into how you fly. You need to learn it, understand it, make it part of, it can't be something you discover when all of a sudden it starts yelling at you.
I think angle of attack is going to be one of the neat stories of the rest of this decade anyway, as more and more people adopt it. And there's neat systems coming out. I can't wait to fly one that's integrated in my G500 or the next piece of avionics that I buy.
Well, you can come up and fly our Bonanza and check out the Aspen AOA that's integrated, because that's one that you don't even have to look at. You can set it to come up only when you need it.
Okay.
Or something like that. And I'll just say that, you know, sometimes you use it for things like at night. Obviously, I fly out of an airport that's very small and it's dark, lots of trees around it. So at night, it's comforting not to just be flying off airspeed. And in addition to that, though, I've had cases where one in particular where I was flying complete IMC, very smooth, and didn't realize I was in a downdraft. And it was angle of attack that let me realize, hey, why is it that for me to climb at my normal rate when everything seems right and the engine's right and everything's right, why is my angle of attack so high?
Quit pulling, right? And then figure it out.
Exactly. So with that, I would love to really talk about the work you've been doing at the Air Safety Institute and the work that came before you. I'd like to take a moment, of course, to recognize Richard McSpadden. Spad was a good friend of both of ours. He's been here on the show a number of times in the past, and obviously it was a tragedy to lose him. Tell me a little about the transition and stepping into those shoes.
Well, we missed Spad. He was a good friend. As you can imagine, we gave each other a lot of grief because of our service backgrounds, right? He was a legend around here. So it was, 9-10 months before Mark asked me if I was interested in this job. And I jumped at it. And I remember telling Mark Baker, our just recently departed president, I said, I'll jump at it and I'll do it with all my heart, but I'm not going to do it the way Richard did it, because there's no way I could measure up to the quality and experience he had and his whole poise and posture with everything. He was such a great educator and safety advocate. You know, he's just a legend. So I'll do the best I can in my style, and that's what I'm going to do until they ask me not to or I decide to retire, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, he's a great guy, and we all miss him. I know we're all waiting with bated breath for the NTSB report to come out. I try all the time to make sense of what happened, and you can't. You know, we know he was in the right seat. We know, the airplane came short after an engine power loss. We don't know why. We think had they been 15, 20 feet higher, he would have hit the flat grass and even in this job today talking to you again, right?
Yeah.
So it's probably one of those really just wrong place, wrong time, terrible luck. Nothing that the pilot or Richard was on the right seat. We don't even know if he was manipulating the controls. So there's just a lot of unknowns. We really hope that the NTSB digs in hard and doesn't publish unknowns. We hope they dig into it and give us the answers. You know, there's lots of ways they can try to figure that stuff out. So
yeah, we don't like it when you wait such an extraordinary length of time and at the end you get this generic, you know, loss of flight control or something.
Can I just say one more thing about Spad?
Yes, please.
Real quick. So it was not uncommon for me to go by his office and just tell him that hey, thanks for coming to work today. You know, and he would chuckle. And one day we were throwing grief each other's way, and I said, "Listen, I really respect the Air Force, and I do, Jeff. I mean, for the record, I absolutely do. Service to the country is an honorable thing." But I told Spad, I'm not going to give you any more grief, buddy, because, you know, I think the Air Force is an honorable alternative to military service. and only he could know that I do truly respect all service people. And he took it for what it was worth. So if anybody's out there is offended by that, I apologize, but it was meant to be.
So we're going to get all our Navy guests together, and I'm going to give them your home address, and we'll just see how this goes.
Okay.
Air Force, that is. So let's talk about the meat here of air safety, what's happened before, where we are, where we're going. If you were to summarize the biggest message, looking backwards first at how we are doing, what would you say?
We're doing something right. And the safety record is improving for the last 30 plus years, and that is something to celebrate. That's the most important thing. It's the worst kept secret in general aviation, and certainly outside the airport fence lines, how safe general aviation is. And I think we can get to some charts later and show some of that. But we have, when I say we, I don't mean ASI and AOPA. I mean we, the industry, the government and industry partners, and it's truly been a partnership.
Let's bring one up. I mean, this, you talk about data, let's bring one up.
Yeah, so since 1993, we've reduced the accident rate by half. And since 1994, we reduced the fatal accident rate by more than half. Now that is huge, right? When you look at the data, you can see the flight hours, fluctuate with the economy. And sometimes the general aviation accident rate fluctuates with it because the flight hour rate is the denominator, right? If flight hours go down precipitously for some downturn in the economy and GA flying continues, well then, accidents continue, then the rate will go up even though we might have crashed less airplanes. So this is a huge success story. We're down by half or more than half. And we are focused in the Air Safety Institute on the fatal accident rate for obvious reasons. But that's a big success story. We're doing something right. The other side of that is I wish we knew exactly what we were doing to drive the rate down because we would do more of it. We don't know. We don't know if it's just technology, if it's training, if it's awareness. You know, the 10 million hits you mentioned at the beginning of the show. That's our mission at ASI, by the way, is to put out meaningful, deep content to get people to think about how they're flying and change their behavior. You know, there's 195 pilots that had fatal accidents in 2024. That's on our dashboard chart. And I wish I could talk to those 195 pilots to figure out what was the common denominator or common denominators. How many of them were active or inactive in their type club? How many have had a meaningful annual recurrent training flight in the last 3 or 4 years? Were they actually paid to go get some challenging flight training, right? Or when was their last IPC done where they actually did instrument approaches to MINs, on a hood with partial panel and no autopilot? You know, really challenging stuff. That's what I wish I could determine. And maybe with the help of AI, we're actively pursuing a bunch of AI solutions right now to drive into multiple databases to try to weave together what's the story of those 195 for pilots who were in fatal accidents in 2024. What was the common thread or threads? If we can figure that out, we can start really zeroing in our safety content. And if 10 million people want to watch it, great. What I wish in 2024 is those 195 watched.
Right.
That's really where I'm at with my thinking on the content we're driving. And if we get to it, I'll tell you some of the things we're doing starting in 25 this year and beyond that really is going to help us laser beam some of that effort.
Well, we'll definitely get to it. And I'll say that I kind of get your approach on that. It does make sense because on one hand, we can see that so many things seem to be going in the right direction to support safety. The education that you're providing out there. Certainly our goal, as you've been aware, at Social Flight is to make sure all the events, whether they are webinars, whether they are in person, whether they are AOPA events, whether they are fly-ins, whether IMC, VMC club, it doesn't matter. If they are about education, you can find them in Social Flight because we're trying to get people to do that. And we even see that from our partners, companies like Avemco, which has a very strong insurance purpose to, like, they want to reduce the accident rate. And so they are putting so much effort and time and thoughtful and funding to help that. So all these people are pulling in that direction. And then at the same time, technology's getting better. We talked about, companies like Aspen, we've got Avidon, we've got UAVionics that are just so focused on safety features and what we can do. And then within all that, we still have, like you said, I love the way you put that, is that's great. Like the answer is yes, we think it's all helping. But talk to me a little bit about what makes up those failures. I'll bring up that I hate to call it failures, but when someone passes, that's what we have.
That's a great chart. So the accident rate is going down, and the fatal accident rate is going down. 30 plus years, great glide slope, and we're going to keep doing that. I'm very confident. This chart is a product of the General Aviation Joint Safety Committee, which I'm the industry co-chair of. It's myself, Sean Elliott at the EAA, and Kim Pyle at the FAA. And there's 30 other organizations that have leaders on this committee, plus a whole bunch of FAA employees. And it's really a data-driven, analysis of the trends and what can be done about it. Because everybody who can do something about it is in that room or connected to that room. And we meet quarterly. So that's a very awesome committee that I'm on, and it's really helped us zero in on where we need to focus for educational training. And what you do by echoing all the training opportunities, that's critical. That is absolutely critical. We've had a great partnership with Social Flight for a long time, and that's one of the reasons is all the help you're giving the industry to put the word out on where the training opportunities are. So while the accident rates are going down, fatal and non-fatal, the ugly truth is we're not inventing new ways to crash airplanes, and we're certainly not inventing new ways to kill ourselves. While the rates go down, the top 10 causes have stayed mostly the same. And this kind of speaks to it, but 42% of the fatal general aviation accidents are loss of control in flight. Loss of control in flight. You think there's a benefit here that AOA could help us with?
Yeah, no kidding.
Right? If losing control of flight, you're losing the Bernoullis somewhere.
Let me ask you for clarification. Because you have different things here, like system component failure, power plant, system component failure, non-power plant. When you have a case, for example, where you do have a failure in the aircraft, and then you have an accident, sometimes it seems like reading the NTSB report makes it summarizes as, this major thing happened to the plane, but ultimately it was the pilot's fault, so we only call it loss of control. How do I use this chart to understand that?
You don't. You'd have to read 20, 30, 40 NTSB accident reports, the final reports. Your example is right on the money, though. So unintentional IMC, there's 4% of those in all of the accidents. And this is over like a 12-year period since 08. So this is all the data. But it doesn't change if you shorten up the time span. Unintentional IMC, VFR into IMC is a killer, okay? It can be. But it leads to either CFIT or loss of control in flight.
Right.
Or it leads to something you never read about because there wasn't an accident. You actually do the 180 and you egress the IMC and you got out of it, right? So unintentional IMC is not the killer. It's the pilot error step of pushing a bad situation too far, and then you either do what you were taught, which is do the 180 turn and slowly and coordinated and try to get yourself out of there, or you don't do that well and you lose control and you spin in. I mean, that's just what happens. Or you go too low, right? You start pressing it, you start going lower, and you hit a tower. I mean, or hit terrain that way. So there's a lot to unpack in this data. You'd have to read a lot of accident reports to get to that level, but you're right on the money, Jeff, is some of these are the precursor that led to the chain of events that caused the fatal. And the fatal wasn't, VFR and IMC. It was loss of control or CFIT or something else, right? So on that note, I can tell you that GHASC, which is the leadership committee, has a safety analysis team. We've got some people at AOPA's Air Safety Institute on the safety analysis team, and then they appoint safety enhancements, deep dive groups that go in for 3-4 quarters and dive into a topic. So Rob Geske, our manager for safety analysis, just completed a deep dive into VFR and IMC, a whole bunch of accidents, fatal and non-fatal, and just made some recommendations to the GAJSC, which they're going to adopt at our next meeting next month. And it's going to go into the FAA system for acceptance and then put it into action, or whatever that action is going to be. It's a little bit of a slow process, but it worked. And the point is unintentional IMC, we think, can be really helped if we improve the training. You might remember that to get your private pilot's license, you have to have 3 hours of instrument training, which usually means put on the foggles, put on the hood, and with your flight instructor in the right seat and fly around as if you're an instrument, right? Nowhere in the ACS does it really talk about what you're supposed to really achieve or learn from those 3 hours. I mean, the first hour, you're gonna learn a lot. Okay, I can fly the airplane without looking outside. It's a confidence builder, you know how it is. But the goal should be to successfully extract yourself from that IMC situation.
Right.
And we're trying to, once this recommendation is adopted by the FAA, then we're gonna turn in, put our hats around and get into the advocacy mode and push the right meaty changes to the ACS. We're not gonna add time to the PPL. We're gonna add depth to the training quality of what's involved in those 3 hours. That's what our goal will be. So that's one of the examples of what we do with this GAJSC is we dive deep into some of these causes. We figure out what can be done reasonably, effectively, and then we put gas on that and go.
I love that. And are there opportunities in that for instead of hard, you know, things like you should do this, you should do that, to instead kind of have encouragements also? Because one of the things, I'm an IFR pilot, fly a decent amount of IMC. And what I discovered, if I were to look back on my own training, is it was really quite remarkable how true IMC was not part of it at the primary level, at the sort of secondary IFR level, and foggles just didn't cut it. When it came to that. And so you can't just magically say this is available all the time. Anybody can go up in those conditions. But I felt in my own training, and I still don't witness it much today, that when the opportunities existed, I felt like where are the instructors taking these students up of any level and saying, hey, I'm gonna show you what it's like. Let's go into IMC, let's get out of it. Let's show you what it's like, and just to give some knowledge and maybe even some I guess reflex so that someone doesn't just panic and do absolutely nothing.
Right. No, I'm on the same wavelength. In fact, I asked my wife's flight instructor to do exactly that when he gets to those 3 hours of, you know, required instrument training and he said he was going to do it anyway. That's what he does with his students. He gets a block altitude, gets an IFR clearance, and then finds where he can go in and out of the clouds and trains. You know, it's incredible.
That's good to hear.
If we're successful, we'll get some depth and clarity written into the airman certification standards. And when that happens, instructors will teach to that, knowing that the DPEs will test to that. And that's the idea. We don't want to add requirements. We want to add quality of training.
Yeah. Right. That makes perfect sense. The other area I'd like to ask you about is, of course, my professional world as a mechanic and an IA is really focused on the idea of we don't want the aircraft to fail the pilot. Obviously, at that point, the pilots, if they do everything right, hopefully they're still okay. But how can we use this data to answer this key question that I don't know the answer to, and you may already know the answer to, which is, okay, great, we're looking at all these time frames. Are aircraft failing us more or less? Are they, how are the actual mechanical, you can go from that to say, are they being maintained better or worse or whatever, but ultimately, are we in a more reliable or a less reliable environment? Is there a trend there?
You know, I have a gut feeling, Jeff, but I don't know if I have the data. I'll bet you I can get it, but I don't know if I can tell you the trend is better. A system component failure, power plant is the number two cause. 10% of all fatal accidents are caused by a power plant failure, partial or full, right? And then system component failure, non-power plant is 4% of all fatal accidents. So what I can't answer quantifiably right now is, was it 12% 10 years ago or 20 years ago? My gut tells me it's going down because the technology is improving. I mean, my Bonanza's got a glass panel in it, and it didn't have that when it came off the factory floor in 72, right?
Right.
And it's got an AOA indicator now. It's got weather and traffic, and, you know, it's incredible. So you know, I've got the upgraded 550 engine with 500 hours on it. So that's, you know, probably going to be pretty strong for the next 10 or 15 years, I hope, right? Knock on wood. I think I
certainly don't mean to put you on the spot for that. It's an area that I think the industry needs to answer some, because we've always gotten that message, which you reiterated and is certainly accurate, which is there are all different areas of our aircraft that we fly in general aviation that have improved, and avionics being the biggest one. I mean, bar none, have improved reliability, no vacuum punt issues, like all sorts of ways that we know they've gotten better. And yet, at the same time, we've got a crisis of not enough mechanics. We've got shops that are stressed. We've got increasing prices and changing supply chains, and a lot of components on aircraft, no matter what they are, they're still the same mechanical components that they were maybe 50 years ago. If you need parts for your Bonanza that are physical, they're probably going to be the same if they're not avionics related. And so the question I've always had is, again, not for right now, but it would be really good to know how we're doing and what we can improve.
I'll take an action, Jeff, and shoot you an email with if there's a trend line on power plant system component failure. You got me interested in that now.
Well, I did not intend to give you homework when it came to this.
No, that's okay. I love it. That's what I do, man. I love it.
So there's another chart I would like to talk to you about that really has to do with success, and it is how we're doing in the last year, I guess it is. Tell me about this.
Well, 2024 was we think will be the safest year on record behind 2021, which was before. The caveat here is this is all pre-decisional. We published the numbers you just saw a minute ago. Our 2022 fiscal year data, which has all of the NTSB accident reports, are now final. There's no more doubt about causes and what, you know, all that. So this data here is our dashboard that we track, and it was fiscal year 24. It ended September 30th. We had 195 fatal accidents, and the goal for 2024 set by the GAJSC and the FAA was 253. So we beat that by 58 accidents, which is excellent. We were 58 under the goal. Now, I want to talk about the goal for a minute. You know, why in the heck isn't the goal zero, right? That's a good question. One fatality is one too many, certainly. But the GAJSC, working with the industry and the FAA together, put in a 10-year goal to reduce the fatal accident rate by 10%, 1% per year. And if my memory serves, we achieved that at the 7-year point. We beat it. Right. So we've improved faster than we set our own goal to achieve. And this 2024 is a continuation of that. Had we had only 253 fatal accidents, we would have been on track on our descent glide slope. That would have been 1% less than 2023. But we beat that by coming in at 195. We have to wait a while now for the FAA to give us the flight hour activity for 2024. With that number, then we can derive the rate, or the FAA will derive the rate. And we think that flight hours are still increasing. GA is booming right now, as you know. I mean, people are flying their butts off, which is great. You know, go out and fly more. And if the flight hour activity is up like we think it will be, we think 2024 will math itself out to be the safest year on record, and another one for us to beat, you know, next year and the year after. So
yeah,
we're doing something right. I just wish I knew exactly what we were doing so we could do more of it.
Exactly right. And like you said, you hammer on the ones that are the tragedies, and then I wish we knew more about what we were doing right, but at least we're doing something right. The other thing which I really like about the work that you're doing, the work that AOPA is doing in this regard, is this trend seems to be supporting many other things that makes our lives better. Mark Baker had really mentioned that it was the data in this trend that is helping to support basic med, for example.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we track all the NTSB accidents very closely with a keen eye towards, was basic med a causal factor, right? And the answer is it hasn't been. If it's present on the data chart, it's a sliver. Basic Med has not been an instigator of more accidents or more fatal accidents, which is what we thought after we watched all the light sport rule industry for 10 years. So when my former boss, Jim Kuhn, and Mark Baker succeeded in getting Basic Med through third class medical reform back in 2018, I guess it was, part of that legislation was that the FAA owed a report to Congress to report on itself in 5 years. And what's the truth? What's going on with Basic Med since it was now a pathway? Over 80,000 pilots have now certified to use it at one point or another, which is a wild success. And Basic Med as a safety causal factor is, there's nothing to see here, folks. Keep moving. It's great, as we expected, right? So that's a beautiful thing. And, it's probably something we'll talk more closely with the insurance industry about, because, we're hearing a lot of from our members about how they're getting told they have to go get a Class 3 every year once they reach a certain age. We've already started engaging with the insurance industry in a very collaborative, open way, but to show them what we see with the data. And one of them was the data and the FAA report to Congress that showed that Basic Med is equal to Class 3. We've got senior AMEs that have attested that it's the same physical, it's the same checklist. And really, the only difference between the doctors is one had to go to a 5-day AME course to be able to sign off Class 3 medicals. They're still doctors, right?
Yeah.
I'm probably oversimplifying the difference, and no offense to any AMEs. But the good news here is that Basic Med has been a wild success and has not caused more accidents. And that's a great news story.
Yeah, and it really supported the reauthorization, the FAA reauthorization changes, which affected Basic Med and had an impact on many of those things. I think the data that you've got here that you're tracking, and the trend and the fact that it's working in our direction for increased safety, that things are going well in that regard, supports expansion of what works.
They did expand Basic Med with the most recent FAA reauthorization, but with a GA title. We're up to 12,500 pounds. DPEs can now give check rides on Basic Med. It's really a great thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it can support our industry. And I think as that continues to move in the direction of things that make it possible for more people to fly, that make it possible for more people to get treated for whatever conditions that they have and still safely fly, instead of proving that people can do this now, it just widens the pool. And as long as it isn't threatening safety, which you're demonstrating, it's good for everybody.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's a wild success story. I know Mark Baker was extremely proud of that. I know Darren Pleasance, our new president CEO, will be pushing more of that. I'm sure he's gonna keep pushing the Basic Med to be accepted in Canada. We've been doing that for 5 years, and that's not a success we've scored yet, but we will eventually,
I certainly hope so. I'm right up here in Boston. I want to see those walls come down to Basic Med in Canada.
Well, Mexico and the Caribbean have accepted it, and I know there's a lot of advocacy work going on there in our DC office. So.
Absolutely. So tell me about moving forward now, 2025, moving forward and beyond. What are your goals?
For ASI, I have this will be more public about late June, July timeframe, right before Oshkosh. But, I committed when I started this job to look back and see what was working, do more of that, see what's not working, and do less of that, right? Simple stuff here. So one of the things that my team has, they dove in and found out that we have some really rich content that's 12, 15, 18 years old. And it's what put ASI on the map 2 decades ago was our interactive courses, really high rich content, but they're a little bit dated now. So the content needs to be refreshed and put into what people are watching today, which is YouTube, right? That's where people consume their content. We know that. 5 million of our 10 million impressions are from YouTube people, right? So it's amazing. So we're refreshing all that old content. It's going to be a multi-year project. We're going to keep producing the flagship videos we do now, accident case studies, and real pilot stories, and early analysis videos. But we're going to add the refresh of some older content with it. That is, it's good evergreen material, but it's a little bit dated. And that's an exciting project. We've already gotten five topics off the ground. We're actively writing scripts, soliciting for subject matter experts, filming the content, you know, then we're going into the editing process. So we've kind of created a little factory here at ASI. And you'll see that coming out with probably a little more of a public relations blast in late June, early July. But that's the first time I've talked about that publicly right here on your show, Jeff. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you for breaking news.
We are very excited about that. And we're focusing on, as you can imagine, loss of control in flight, unintentional IMC, system component failure, and some other things like human factors and mental health and aeronautical decision-making, the underpinning foundational parts of what leads you and I to do the right thing in the cockpit, right? So we won't know if we see a knee in the curve because of this for 5 or 10 years. And who's going to say it's because of this or the next big thing that got squirted into the software update in our boxes? Who knows? I just know we're going to keep working hard at doing it. It's a worthy cause, and I love doing it.
Perfect. Well, I am certainly grateful for the work that you're doing and the success that you and your whole organization there is having in helping all of us out there. Well, Mike, it is time for something that we like to call Social Flight's Fast Five. You up for that?
I am.
All right. Mike Ginter, this is your Social Flight Fast Five. Five questions to get to know you a little bit better and all of the work that you're doing at AOPA's Air Safety Institute. Let's start with question number one. You have flown all sorts of different aircraft going back to your original civilian time, your time in the Navy, and then beyond. Out of all that, what's the one that really is closest to your heart of the aircraft that you've flown?
T-6, hands down.
Tell me, take me in the cockpit of a T-6.
1943, my SNJ was built. It was a unrestored, ugly duckling, really. I worked on the mechanics of it, rebuilt the hydraulics, the landing gear system, overhauled the motor, but it was in desperate need of a paint job. But, you know, that was a discretionary $50,000 bill that I just didn't have money to do, right? The T-6 was the most gratifying, challenging airplane I ever flew. It was also the first tail dragger I ever flew. I got my tail wheel endorsement in a T-6.
Oh.
I mean, it was 12 hours, and then I flew with another pilot for a long time until I had the requisite hours for my insurance company. But it's the airplane that really makes you fly. The military called it the pilot maker, and that was there for a reason for that. It's you have to fly it all the time. It's constantly keeping the airplane coordinated, and if the airplane's not coordinated and you're loaded up on G in a turn, it'll tell you in a heartbeat by flipping over, and you know you have to be able to handle that. And we trained to that all the time. When I was the T-6 owner and then the president of North American Trainer Association, I would go and get an annual recurrent training flight every year from either Warbird Adventures down in, in Kissimmee at the time, they're up in South Carolina now, or Stallion 51. It was just world-class training, and it was expensive, but it was absolutely worth every penny. And that's what I tell pilots now, is if you're going to do anything to make yourself better, go get some recurrent training from a tough, good, reputable school, and don't come out of it until you're sweating. I guarantee you, you'll take stuff with it. You'll take stuff with you.
I love that. All right. Question number two. When you think back on your flying, was there any particular either scary or very impactful moment in your life that you feel changed the way you approach aviation?
In my life? Or my flying
life? Either one. What comes to mind?
I had a near mishap on the USS America, 1989. I was deployed with my first deployment as a young lieutenant. And I was hyper-focused on improving my landing grades. You know, you fly meatball lineup, angle attack, all the way to touchdown. Every landing is graded. Every landing is filmed. If you're in the ready room when you're not flying, you're watching the you know, the Platt television. You can see them happening live. You can hear them hitting the roof above you. And there's a green board in the ready room. It shows all the green tiles for the 4-0 passes. The, you know, an okay pass, you get a green tile. It's worth 4 points. That's what you want. A yellow tile was a fair pass, a 3.0. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I had yellows all over the place, and I was like the banana man. I mean, I couldn't get a green to save my life. So I was putting all this pressure on myself to do better. And it resulted in me overcorrecting a lineup excursion in close, landing on the ship at night. And I did a right for lineup. The LSO is called right for lineup. So I do a little bit of a right wing dip to correct back on the center line. And I apparently was so focused on being perfect that I overcorrected to the point where my right wing tip slammed into the flight deck. Now, that's a high wing jet, right? It's a high wing jet. Now, the right wing tip hit the flight deck as I touched down. The good news was I was high because the right wing tip touched down just past the four wire. Thank God it didn't catch the four wire. It might have been a different outcome. So I trap, and as soon as I trap, they signal me to fold the wings. If wings get folded, now the gash that's on the underside of the right wing is now pointing up, so nobody can see it. And it was an hour or two later that the maintenance guys came down and started asking me questions. And point is I thank God I only did some skin damage to this aluminum housing. I didn't damage the antennas inside, but I ended up getting a cut pass. It was a black tile. And it was for an unsafe act inside the wave off window. And so here I am trying so hard to do better. And I did. I tried so hard, I actually did as worst as I could possibly do, and it had an unsafe event. So I ended up riding the pine for a couple of days. Skipper put me on the bench to let me think about the errors in my ways. And it kind of caused me to just settle back and relax and accept, you know, just do the best you can and quit trying to think you're better. I mean, that's what it was. I thought I was better. I wanted to prove it, and I wasn't. I was an average pilot, and average is perfect. If you can hit the three wire without any big excursions in the groove, then you can keep doing that your whole career and be fine. You get promoted. So that was the biggest thing I learned there, was to slow down a little bit, relax, accept where you are in life, to quit thinking you're better than you are. And that helped me out later in life.
What a wonderful lesson. I really do appreciate that. And I think that a lot of people can apply that to different aspects of their own lives. So that's really, really, I think, a deep story. Okay. So question number three now. Right. Now, if you had the opportunity to go back to some moment in your life, not to change it, just to something that was so wonderful that if you could just go back and re-experience for 15 minutes or so, where would you put yourself?
Wow, that's a good question, Jeff. I know the answer to this. 2015, May 8th, I pulled off a stupidly unlikely event, which was the first big flyover we did in D.C. May 8th, 2015, the Arsenal of Democracy. Nobody thought it could be done. I didn't know if it could be done. We started getting yeses to all the 11 agencies that had to say yes, and we pulled it off. We had good weather, and nobody got in trouble. Nobody got flight violated, and it was a wild success. The feeling that day, I wish I could relive that. And in fact, I did this past May when we did the AOPA 85th anniversary flyover. But that was an awesome, you know, you put a year plus of time into something, and then it comes out to be thanks to a lot of other factors, the weather and other pilots' performance. That was a great feeling. I could do that again.
That's awesome. And what aircraft were you in?
Well, in 2015, I wasn't. I was in the tower up at National, and I gave my T6 to a buddy of mine. So my airplane was in it, but I was up in the tower. I briefed the event down at Culpeper, and then I jumped in a helicopter and got a ride into National so I could be in the tower to be the air boss.
That's awesome.
In this past May when we did it, I learned some lessons, Jeff. You know, the lesson I learned was in 2015, I got the helicopter ride in, but like a knucklehead, I had pre-staged my car to drive back to Culpeper. Oh, by the way, it was Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It took me 3 hours back to Culpeper. So lesson learned.
You could have gotten a lift out.
Well, I could have, but I couldn't do it real time. I had to plan on it. So in 2024 in May, this past year, we did the national celebration of GA Flyover, and I fixed that. I did the briefing in Frederick, and I stuck around for 30 minutes for questions. And then me and my Secret Service agent buddy, we jumped into Bonanza, flew into National as they were landing the last airplanes and launching the last jets. We were in the tower, and they closed the airport for us, and we had another great wild success. And that's all on our AOPA YouTube channel, by the way.
Absolutely wonderful. Okay, question number four. If you had the opportunity to go back to your younger self, your teens, your 20s, wherever you want to go back to, and give some advice, what would you give to your younger self?
You have got some good questions here. I would tell myself, relax, kid. People can see who you really are. Quit trying to be somebody different. Which kind of was that lesson learned again when I slammed the wing into the flight deck, you know?
Fair enough. It's a good and helpful theme for anyone. And our last question of the evening, question number five, if you could choose anyone alive or no longer with us from history or from present, like and literally anyone to spend an evening with, who would that be?
Jeff Simon, Social Flight Live.
and now the real answer.
By the way, we should do that. I'd like to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Who would I like to spend time with, dead or alive? Well, I would love World War II history. It'd probably be Winston Churchill.
Love it.
Yep.
Love it. That's fantastic.
It's all good. Jeff, you've got some great questions here. These are, I almost wish you would have coached me on those. I could have had some more forethought to them.
Oh, it's not fair if I do it that way, my friend.
Make sure if you ever get Darren Pleasance on here, you ask him those questions too.
You bet. We might have to switch him up because I don't want anybody briefing him. And he will be coming on the show. We have a history of AOPA presidents here at Social Flight Live.
By the way, as of today, January 7th, he's been in the seat for 7 days, and it's really an exciting time at AOPA. We love Mark, and he did fantastic stuff for 11 years, but man, the initial impressions are Darren's going to be a fireball here at AOPA. It's going to be awesome.
That's wonderful. Okay, yeah. So then, you know, you guys have priorities all over the place, but one of them's going to be next time that you sit down for lunch or coffee with him. You tell him it worked out. You survived the beginning, middle, and the end, and he should come on.
Well, I would encourage anybody out there take a look at the February issue of AOPA magazine. It's a really nice couple of stories about him, and one that he wrote and one that we did on him. So it's a great intro.
Fantastic. Well, Mike, thank you so much for taking time to join us here on Social Flight Live this evening. It's been extraordinarily experience of learning about you and your new role and really what's happening in aviation safety and the work at the AOPA Air Safety Institute. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate the partnership with you guys, and I'm sure we'll see you soon.
All right. Have a wonderful evening.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. And thank all of you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday, but with our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff. That is Tuesday, January 14th. Go to Cockpit, the number two, and the word cowl. Cockpit2cowl.com is how you register for that show. And it is a ton of fun. And we have a theme for every show. Brian represents what's happening in terms of from the flight instructor's opinion and the professional pilot's opinion from an airline pilot's perspective. And then I come and bring the side of it from the mechanics and everything else. And we've got a theme for every show. And this next week's show, our theme is common knowledge isn't knowledge. And we're going to talk all about things that have to do with whether they're called old wives' tales or they're called other things, but misconceptions that really matter for your safety and your wallet. And that'll be at cockpittocowl.com for next week on the 14th. Then we're back here on Social Flight Live on the 21st. AirCam creator and Rotax engine guru, Phil Lockwood of Lockwood Aviation. I'll tell you, just go check out the AirCam. If you have any idea you'll ever be touching an aircraft with a Rotax engine, you want to hear from Phil. He is a great friend, more remarkable individual, and has done some amazing things in his life. In fact, astronaut Story Musgrave, that was here on the show, talked about building an air cam with his granddaughter and getting to spend some time with Phil. So with that, I'd like to thank you all again for joining us here on Social Flight Live and wish you all blue skies.